Good morning, and thank you very much for coming to our Yarche Kala. I was commenting to Dan Walter before, we haven't actually done a Yarche Kala on Victoria Weekend in quite a few years. I think just because of when it falls out, a combination of the fact that last year it was on Shavuos, or Shavuos was on Victoria Weekend, depending on how you look at it, I suppose. But between that and the Walk with Israel and so on, we haven't actually done one on this stat holiday. We've done all the others. This is a first. And thank you for turning out. I also want to thank Dan, who is outside right now, but for doing all the work of setting up the breakfast along with the Avrechim and Rabbi Abbey. So thank you very much for all of your help. If anyone has a phone and could put it on vibrate or mute, that would be helpful. I always prefer to ask for that before someone's phone rings. Better that way. And finally, before we start, I also have to give credit where credit is due. I drove to New York and back for Pesach and needed something to do while driving, so I binge listened a series of shiurim, a series of classes on the topic of civil marriage from my friend Rabbi Daniel Feldman as well as Rabbi Baruch Simon, and that gave me a lot to think about, as well as kept me alive during the drive. So I thank them for both. Our topic is civil marriage within halacha, but we're going to be talking about much more than marriage because there are many meta issues that come into play here. The question of how halacha determines the intent of somebody who performs a particular action, as we'll see in the context of marriage, intent becomes very important. Is there a recognition, as I put on the questions on the top of the sheet, is there a recognition in Judaism that human psychology can change, such that assumptions made by the Gemara about what somebody is thinking may not apply a couple of thousand years later? What are the pros and cons, as I put it on the sheet, of using halacha for social engineering? Meaning, I'll tell you the ending. Let's say one were to decide that civil marriage is not marriage halachically, and that they don't need a get, they don't need a bill of divorce in order to end the relationship. But let's say the sages decide that that's not healthy. It's not healthy to have couples live together for a month, 6 months, a year, 20 years, whatever it is, and then simply separate without any sort of halachic act. And therefore, a get would be expected. Is that a good idea? So we're going to talk about all of these elements, I hope, in the course of our discussion. But we start with a basic question. A man and woman get married using a civil marriage ceremony. And I gave you on your sheet, sources 2, 3, and 4, examples of civil marriage ceremonies, none of them local. As you can see, one of them is from the UK, one of them is from Cyprus, and one of them is from India. And you see the rituals there, and we'll talk about the rituals themselves in a little bit. But let's say a couple gets married using one of these rituals. What's the harm in saying, let's treat this as a halachic marriage? Let's say, I don't know. I don't know whether this counts as a halachic marriage or not, so let's be strict, and let's say we'll view this as a halachic marriage. What do you lose, potentially, by doing that? What's the price you pay? There's a need for a get, right? Once we call it a halachic marriage, there's now a need for a get, which means that in the event that she gets married to somebody else afterwards, without a get, and they have a child, the child is a mamzer, right? Which creates all sorts of problems for that person's life. Not only that, what about the following case? A man and a woman are not particularly observant, or not observant at all. And they get married with a civil ceremony. They have no interest in a Jewish ceremony at all. And then in the course of the marriage, the wife starts becoming observant. She grows, she evolves, and she says, you know what, I've decided I want to become observant. And the guy says, no way, I want nothing to do with this. And ultimately, unfortunately, it happens, it leads to a divorce. She goes to the rabbi and says, what do I have to do at this point? He says, well, you need a get. The husband's not at all interested. Number one, he's not interested because he feels like she changed in the course of the marriage and it's unfair to him and so on. So he's bitter about that. But number two, He's completely secular. He has no interest whatsoever in a get. She can end up in a situation which we call aguna. She is now stuck. She is unable to get remarried because she is waiting on a get. That's another ramification. Third ramification. After this, if you're going to require a get, potentially she is unable to... She's unable to marry a Kohen, right? The rule is that once divorced, a woman is not able to marry a Kohen. Now, you've created a problem all because you said, well, let's just be strict. There are more problems that come up in this regard. But you can't simply say, we'll treat it as a halachic marriage and require a get, misafek, out of doubt. That's simply not an acceptable solution. We need to come up with something better than that. So that's where we're going to go with this, is this discussion about, so what exactly is civil marriage in the eyes of Jewish law? So in order to do that, we have to know what marriage is within halacha. So marriage has two stages, kiddushin and then nisuin. Today, we do them together. Historically, you actually did the kiddushin stage and then waited months, up to a year, before doing nisuin. We're going to focus on kiddushin. That's the stage that matters for the purpose of our conversation this morning. There are three different avenues for kiddushin. I put them on your sheet in source number one. Three different ways you can create kiddushin. The first way is kesef. Literally, I'm translating it as money, although it could also be a monetary equivalent. And as I wrote on the sheet, a man presents a woman something of some value. The currency that's mentioned in the Gemara is a pruta. The pruta we had a shear about months ago, and we said it's somewhere around a nickel. Somewhere between a nickel and a dime. Whether we're going to require more than that or not was a shear again that we already dealt with, not discussing that now, but you give her something of minimal value. That is kesef, in front of witnesses. Very important. Kosher witnesses are required. Or shtar. Shtar is a document. A man gives a woman a document declaring that they are married. That's it. That's shtar. That's not the ketubah. Ketubah is a different thing. Ketubah is a document that formalizes his duties to her in the context of marriage. It is a different thing. It is not kiddushei shtar. There is discussion about this by various writers, but I'm going to oversimplify by saying that. But that's kiddushei shtar. And then the third way to do it is bia, marital relations. And even though the Talmud says we don't want people doing this, the Gemara says that it would actually whip somebody if he tried to do this, nonetheless, it's effective. Yes, sure. Yeah. If what? Can I define it? Right. So I'm going to say, for the purpose of this conversation, a male who believes in Torah and is Shomer Shabbos.
And not related to you?
And not related to you. Yeah, that's a good point. Not related. I'm not going to define what related means. It's more than we really need. That's a quick definition, which has various holes, but it'll do for our purpose. So, kiddushin is carried out via kesef, shtar, or bia, giving something of value, giving a document that says, we're married, or I'm marrying you, or sexual relations. Those are your options. Now let's look at what happens in civil marriage. And again, I brought you in 2, 3, and 4 off of various websites. I deliberately did not choose North America. I wanted something a little exotic. UK, Cyprus, and India. So in the UK one, it's fascinating. They have a first paragraph which talks about how when you go to get married, someone's going to make a statement to you about marriage. You're not allowed to use religious words in the civil ceremony, but you could have readings, songs or music in an essentially non-religious context. And then the second paragraph is the part that's relevant for us. Each partner is required to repeat a standard set of promises. These may not be changed. I can't find a list of what those promises are. But they may be added to, as long as the additions are not religious. Rings are not required, but can be exchanged if the couple wishes to. After the ceremony, the marriage register is signed by both partners. Two witnesses, who must be over 16, must also sign at the time of the marriage. A certified copy of the entry in the register may be obtained for a fee. So, repeating a standard set of promises, no need to give a ring, and the marriage register is signed by both partners. Does this look like Kiddushei Kesef?
No.
No. You can give a ring, but even if you do give a ring, it could be a wash. He gives a ring to her, she gives a ring to him. If they're of equal value, then he hasn't actually given her anything. He's just traded one ring for another. That's not Kiddushin. Is it shtar?
No, because
well, there's no shtar at all. He never gives her a shtar.
What about a copy of the register?
Yeah, but does he ever give it to her? A certified copy of the entry in the register is hardly a document that he gives to her saying, we're married. Shtar has to be given from him to her. Take a look at number three, please. Cyprus. It's actually a very interesting website because you know, you have to remember when you're dealing with Cyprus, you're dealing with two conflicting jurisdictions in terms of who's actually in charge in Cyprus. Nonetheless, and I don't mean Israel. Israel's the third jurisdiction for Israelis who are getting married in Cyprus. The wedding ceremony is a very simple procedure, we are told in bold. The duration is approximately 10 to 15 minutes, and when completed, the couple receives the original signed wedding certificate from the wedding officer in charge. Do you notice, by the way, on both of those, they emphasize the duration? Someone should do this for Jewish weddings.
Uh-huh.
We should have that on the invitation. The wedding ceremony will be 10 to 15 minutes. But again, you're receiving the original signed wedding certificate from the wedding officer in charge. There's no kesef requirement here that I can see. There's no shtar one. By the way, the Cyprus one is very nice. The website, because they give you on the same page as the directions for how to get married, they give you also pictures and links for various places in Cyprus where you can get married. It's an advertisement for the wedding industry. And then India. The marriage may be solemnized at the office of the marriage officer and so on. No marriage is complete and binding unless each party says to the other, ... I so-and-so take thee, so-and-so to be my lawful wife / husband. So they have to make a declaration to each other, and then the certificate shall be signed by the parties to the marriage and the three witnesses, and that's evidence of the marriage. I don't see kesef here. I don't really see shtar here. At least there's a declaration going on. You have a declaration happening. But that's really about it. So given the differences between the halachic ceremony of Kiddushin and the civil ceremony, and as I said, Nisuin is not even a discussion, meaning there's nothing here that resembles chuppah. There's nothing here that resembles yichud, being alone together. Nisuin is not even part of the conversation. But given the differences between kiddushin, which we have, and the civil ceremony, why would anybody think that civil marriage should work? Why isn't the answer civil marriage is not marriage? Where is there a possible resemblance? So under kesef, there really isn't much to work with. Rabbi Yosef Abitan, in an article, if you flip to source number 5, I apologize, by the way, I accidentally printed a premature set of source sheets, so the ones that you have don't have the neat logo in the upper right-hand corner, and they also don't have for all of the sources quoted where and when they were written. The version that I emailed out does have everything, so you got it that way. Yes?
Relatives to the people?
Yeah, the witnesses in halacha cannot be related to the people about whom they would be testifying.
Why is that?
Because if you have a stake in what's going on, right, in a particular conclusion, it might bias your testimony. So that's the fear. Can you imagine if we would allow their relative who either really likes the in-law or doesn't like the in-law? Like, you don't want them involved in testifying in general. You want someone who's not related. So take a look at number 5. Rabbi Yosef Abitan wrote an article, as you see, called Hashlachotav Shal Get L'Chumra. What happens if you require a get as a stringency and all the problems that can result? But he says, and I brought you the Hebrew, but I'm going to be pretty consistent just reading my translation where it's on the sheet in the interest of time. He says, some are concerned for Kiddushei Kesef with this marriage because it is traditional for the husband to give the woman a ring after the civil ceremony is completed. And logically, he spoke with her about Kiddushin, so we know that it's on his mind. This would be conditional on having witnesses when the ring is given, but you're going to need to have witnesses to that giving of the ring. You will have to make sure that it's only him giving her a ring and not her giving him back something of equal value, or again, you're potentially in a wash situation. But generally speaking, no one accepts the idea that the ring is going to count, even if he does give it and she doesn't give him one back. Just because it's commonly understood the ring is a gift. He's not thinking of the ring as this is the way the marriage is becoming halachically effective. No one seriously approaches it as kiddushei kesef. There is an argument that is made for kiddushei shtar, arguing that the marriage license will constitute a document for the sake of marriage. The Mar Chalev wrote this, Rav Yehuda Lev Tzirelson, and the Chazon Ish seems to have said this. If you take a look at source number 6, we have a letter from the Chazon Ish where he writes, again, reading my translation, regarding civil marriage, the halacha has not yet been fixed. He's writing the middle of the 20th century. They do not want zinut, meaning they don't want a relationship outside of marriage, but a transactional bond. Even though they have strayed from the path of Torah, and so long as they perform a transaction which is biblically effective, then even if their intent was for a human transaction rather than a Torah transaction, still it is effective. At the end of the day, they want to get married, they want to live together in an enduring relationship. That's good enough. Therefore, if the husband gave her the signed form, there could be room for concern for kiddushin via document, and perhaps it does not lack preparation with her in mind, meaning there's a discussion about the document you use for kiddushin with a shtar. There's a question of, does it have to be written with all the rules that we associate with other legal documents, and in particular with a get, where we require it be written with the people involved in mind? So perhaps it doesn't lack that. It's written for this purpose. That is the marriage license. It's written for them. And when they come to dwell together, perhaps their mind is on that which bound them together. It is hard to decide such serious matters. And he says, in any case, one should not break the barrier today when they will see they could marry within 3 months after dissolution such a marriage without a get. There will be a breaking of barriers. He ends up saying, you know what? I think it is a good idea to require a get. And his reason has nothing to do with the halacha here, but it's really part of our social engineering discussion we have to get to. One of the rules of marriage and divorce in Judaism is that after a couple divorces with a get, she needs to wait 3 months before she can remarry. Why? Make sure that she's not pregnant. Because otherwise, she gets married to somebody else, and then after 7 months has a child, 7, 8 months, whatever it is, well, you didn't wait 3 months in between, and now I don't know paternity. I don't know who the father is. So you require a wait for 3 months. However, if you don't require a get, she can get married right away. There's no such restriction. So the Chazon Ish is worried about that, and so he wants to make sure that there is going to be a get. But because he thinks it might be shtar. The Minchas Asher of Asher Weiss said, well, first of all, as we've already seen in 3 different examples of civil marriage, there is no document that the man is handing the woman. That's simply not there. So the mechanism is missing. But Rav Asher Weiss, who I brought you in source number 7, takes this apart. And he says the Chazon Ish didn't actually mean this as a straight halachic argument. Signing a form, he says, is not creating a shtar. The form is not necessarily handed over, as we've already said. He says the whole system in the civil marriage is not the same conceptually as the halachic marriage. And further, he says, that's not the way it works. In Kiddushin, when you do Kiddushin via handover of a shtar, handover of a legal document, you give the document, and that's the moment when the marriage takes place. He says in the civil ceremony, the giving over of this document is an afterthought. It's what happens after everything is done. What actually makes the marriage binding in the civil ceremony is when you say, right, the list of promises. Or when you affirm or confirm or declare whatever it is in all the different websites that I looked at, that you are not married to anybody else and you wish to marry this person to whom you are not related. That's when the marriage takes place. Not with a handover of a document. That's just, oh, would you like proof that you got married? Okay, fine, you can take this home. That's all it is. It's not actually an act of marriage. So shtar, making the argument that this is kiddushin via document, is very weak. However, The third point is the most significant in halacha, and it's the one that really sets us on our way here. And that is the argument for bia, that when they live together as husband and wife, that is what creates the marriage. And just to be crude, but to be clear, when I say live together as husband and wife, I don't mean that they're occupying the same dwelling. I mean sexual relations are what create this marriage. That's what actually generates the marriage. What's my basis for thinking that that's what creates the marriage? Take a look, please, at source number 8. For anyone who came in late and doesn't have pages, there are still source sheets on the table back middle here.
Are you not allowed to exchange rings with women?
So, in halachic marriage, we tend to avoid anything that could create a wash, where what they're doing is equal. So what I know some have done in the case of wanting to make sure that he gives her a ring and that she also, that whatever, they each get rings in the end, is I've seen them do the husband give her the ring under the chuppah with the formal ceremony and so on, and later on she gives him a ring, but making clear that it's not part of the ceremony, it's not a trade, and so forth. But that's something I would leave to the individual rabbi at hand to figure out how to do it. Sorry? So it will take me a little bit of field from where we are, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but basically, if he's supposed to give her something of value, so he gives her a ring that's worth $300, right? And she gives him a ring that's $300, has he given her anything of value?
Yes.
No, because she paid him $300 for it. She gave him a $300 ring in exchange for it. She doesn't come out ahead. You need to make sure that she comes out clearly ahead on this. But we can talk about it after, but that's sure. So, there is support for the idea that in the event that they live together with marriage in mind, that constitutes marriage. Take a look, please, at source number 8. 8 and 9 are the sources in the Gemara for this idea. Itmar, it was learned. If he, a man, does kiddushin conditionally, so he does the kiddushin conditionally, saying that in the event that such and such, then we will be married, on condition that, fill in the blank for your favorite condition, and then marries her, goes through with the marriage without repeating the condition. He didn't say it again. And then the condition was not fulfilled. Okay, so he said to her, he's going to marry her on condition that the Leafs win the Stanley Cup. That's the condition. One could argue that's a smachta, because he doesn't actually believe that's ever going to happen. Nonetheless, he says he marries her on condition, I'll do it better. He marries her on condition that a Canadian team is going to win the Stanley Cup. Okay, sometime in the next 5 years. That's his condition. And at the time of the Nisuin, he doesn't restate the condition. He said it at the time of the Kiddushin. He didn't state it at the time of the Nisuin under the chuppah. And now, the question is, what does that mean? Did he decide to forget the condition? That was really funny, but I'm not actually serious about it. And therefore, the marriage is binding. Or do we say, he forgot to mention it, but it is still significant? How do we understand his omission of the condition at the time of the Nisuin? That's the Gemara's question in source number 8. And the condition is not fulfilled. The Canadian team does not win the cup. So are they married or not married? The condition wasn't fulfilled. Did the condition matter, or did he forget the condition? So Rav says she needs a get from him. Rav says they are married. Shmuel says no get is needed. They're not married. Abaye explains the debate. He says, don't assume that Rav's reason for saying they are married is, since he married her without the condition, he must have forgiven it. Don't take that approach. Rather, Rav's reason is, in the Hebrew, Ein Adam Oseh Be'ilato Be'ilat Zinut, the man does not want his relations to be, or they don't want their relations to be, promiscuous. That's the issue here. And therefore, we read the fact that they went on to live together as demonstration that they intend to be married now via the act of Bia, via the relations that they had. Yes, Shane.
So, all of these discussions so far have been about what do we infer. But there are cases, especially with civil versus religious marriage, where people are making an explicit decision saying, we don't want to have a Jewish marriage. marriage, therefore we're going to city hall.
We are getting there. You are correct. We are getting there. I just need a little bit more time first. You're ahead of me. So what the Gemara in Ksuvos is suggesting, and this introduces a psychological element into the whole shiur, what we're saying in source number 8 is if we see them living together, we assume that that's for the sake of marriage. That they are having marriage in mind. That's the idea. Take a look at number 9, which is the other case in the Gemara where this comes up. Mishnah says, a man and woman get divorced. They went to the Beit Din, they got divorced. That night, they're on the road, and they both stay together in the same inn. Okay. Beit Shammai, and when we say stay together, we mean they had access to each other. They're in the same room, whatever it is. So Beit Shammai says, she doesn't need a new get. We don't assume that something happened with intention for marriage on that night. However, Beit Hillel says, actually, she needs a new get. We assume that whatever happened that night was with intention for marriage. That's the statement that Beit Hillel makes. On the assumption, as we go through the source here, that their divorce came after they had been fully married, and therefore they were comfortable with each other, and therefore it's more likely that they fell into this act. That's the Mishnah. And on the Gemara says we're talking about where there are witnesses to the fact that they had relations with each other. So what we're saying here is, once again, we are going to mind read. And we're going to say that if they slept together, we assume it was with intention for marriage. Well, on that basis, you can make the argument, a man and woman get married with a civil ceremony today. They sleep together. Their intention is for the sake of marriage, not for znut, not for a promiscuous relationship. And therefore, halachically, they are married. That's the argument, not the kesef argument, not the shtar argument that the Chazon Ish put forth, which Rabbi Shirai said he can't possibly mean that literally. The argument is the bia argument, the sexual relations argument. That was done with marriage in mind. Now, we have a lot to talk about in terms of this assumption. But two basic challenges are brought to this before you even get to the more serious questions and challenges of was that really what they meant and so on. You have two basic points. One, the Shagas Aryeh in source number 10, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Ginsberg, argues that made sense back in the time of the Gemara. Because back in the time of the Gemara, it could be that people knew, generally speaking, you can do Kiddushin via money, via document, via bina. If you asked a random Jew on the street in 18th century Lithuania, says the Shagas Aryeh, and I would suggest the same thing is true, 21st century Toronto, if you were to ask your average Jew on the street, does that work as Kiddushin if the two of them sleep together? I would assume, I haven't tried it, right? Tomorrow, I can go to the Walk with Israel out in Bathurst, and I can poll people. I will be more popular than the Neturei Karta demonstration. But my question of, so how does Kiddushin work? Does Kiddushin work through Bia, right? The answer for most people is going to be no. They don't know this is a thing. They don't know that's an option. And therefore, the Shagas Aryeh says, I don't think this makes any sense to assume that they're doing this with marriage in mind. They don't think that actually generates marriage. That's number one. Number two, Rav Asher Weiss argues in the opposite direction, but reaching the same conclusion. He says in number 11, they think they're already married. These people who did the civil ceremony think they are married. They're not thinking at the time of their relations, this is what's going to make us married. They think they're married already. Now, I'm not 100% on the same page, so I think a lot of them do know, and this is the point that Shana was making, they do know there's a difference between civil marriage and religious marriage. So I'm not 100% sold on this argument. He has other arguments to bring anyway. But these are two arguments for saying, discount the whole conversation, you can end your shiur now. There's no issue of considering the bia to be that which would generate halachic marriage. Clear? Okay. So What we're going to see now that we've taken our basic steps, we understand that halachic marriage is through kesef shtar bia, that the most likely candidate within civil marriage to generate marriage is bia, is marital relations between them, if they have in mind that it should be for the sake of marriage. And the argument that we've given is that if they're going to sleep together, it's going to be with marriage in mind, with the notable challenge from the Shagas Aryeh of why would they think that this was actually going to work, and the challenge of Rav Asher Weiss of they think they're married already. There's more to say about Rav Asher Weiss's assumption, but this is that's we're going to see right now. Because now we have to ask the question, as I headed it on your sheet, of how to mind read. How do you determine intent? So in order to address that, we first have to ask a basic question, which I sort of glossed over, but you can't gloss over, which is, what kind of intent do you actually need? What do they have to intend in order to create marriage? What does the intent have to be? What does the intent have to be at the time that they're sleeping together? Just that it's going to be a monogamous relationship with each other? To have it to hold, sickness and health, right? The set of promises. What else might it be? That's one possibility. What else might be the required intent? They may not be a ring in this case. They chose a different route. They didn't choose the ring route. They don't like jewelry. What? Exactly. Those are the two sides. And whether you call that the stringent approach or the lenient approach depends on which way you're looking at it. But there are two different ways to read the intent. I'm going to repeat it. There are two different ways to read the necessity for intent. One way to look at it is to say, all you need to intend is to have marriage, meaning an ongoing monogamous relationship. Nothing Jewish about it. And that's where Rav Asher Weiss's argument makes sense. They think they already have that because they did the civil marriage ceremony. The other way to look at it, Yechiel suggests, is no. Maybe what they need to have is intent for Jewish marriage. Intent for it to be valid as a halachic marriage. Most halachic authorities assume that that's what's necessary. That you actually need to intend not only to be married, but to be halachically married. In source number 12, I brought this for you from the Rivash. Look at his source. He's quoting a Tosefta. Tosefta is a source from the time of the Mishnah. You're going back a couple of thousand years. And it says the following. Any relations which are for the sake of Kiddushin cause Kiddushin. That which is not for the sake of Kiddushin do not create Kiddushin. The fact that they sleep together doesn't simply create a status of Kiddushin. There has to be intent for Kiddushin. Meaning they have to intend it to be a Jewish marriage. And so when they said in the Gemara, Ein adam oseh bilato bilat zinut, that one doesn't intend the relations to be for promiscuous purposes, what that means is, the Gemara's assumption is, a Jewish man, a Jewish woman, sleep together, their intent is that it should be for halachic marriage. That's the idea, that's the idea that is accepted by most authorities. The Rivash, Rabbi Yitzhak ben Sheshet Perfet, in particular, in source number 12, we're going to come back to him. However, there is a dissenting view. And the dissenting view came from Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, one of the primary halachic authorities in North America in the 20th century. And he said, it's not so. He says, the desire to be married is enough. It doesn't have to be married Jewishly. Take a look at source number 13, where he writes, in my humble opinion, it is clear that marriage in secular courts is called for the sake of marriage. For that is what it is named in every language. And he brings you in the original, in number 13, he brings you English, Russian, and German. I only brought you English in the translation. Those who want to read it can read it. But in English, it's called civil marriage. The terms include the word which indicates marriage. They say at that time that he wants her to be his wife, for her to transact with him for this, to be dedicated to him and no other. It's a monogamous relationship. She wants him to be her husband. And one of the languages of Kiddushin is, you are my wife. That works. So Rav Henkin makes the argument that you don't need to intend it to be religious, halachic marriage at all. That's the argument that Rav Henkin brings. So now, what you're saying is that when they sleep together, it becomes marriage halachically, according to Rav Henkin, as long as they intend to have an ongoing monogamous relationship. Whereas according to pretty much everybody else, it seems that the requirement is they have to intend Jewish marriage. Rav Henkin argues that the Rivash actually agrees with him. And the Rivash believes that he's right, and he has a read of it which I brought you in source number 14. I'm not going to go into it right now. But it's a difficult read of the Rivash for sure. But that's the argument, is that you need that level of intent. So now going back to our Gemara. And our Gemara says that when two people sleep together, their intent is for marriage, meaning Jewish marriage. And that's why we treat them as married in the case of the divorced couple who are together again afterwards, for example. So let me ask you the question. What do you think in our day? Do you think that man and woman, Jewish man and woman, who go to get married in a civil ceremony, do you think they intend it to be Jewish marriage, to be halachic marriage?
Where?
In Toronto. Yeah. Toronto City Hall.
But it's a different answer if they're
convinced. Okay, but I'm not dealing with where they're making a point about the Rabbanut. That's not our case. Yes?
So just by sleeping together, that doesn't mean that they have intent of getting married.
Well, that's the question. That's my question.
In my opinion,
that does not. Right. So,
and when you say Jewish marriage, do you mean that they have to have a culture home?
That would be nice, but no, that's not the requirement in this of their intent. Right. So yeah, it's a really hard argument to sustain. But the Gemara said it as a chazaka. So let me go a little further with this.
But the answer is, if you go to the rules about common law marriage, if they've been together for X number of years and seem to be married, then in the eyes of secular society, they are married.
Right. Right. But once again, the same argument will pertain. What kind of intent do I need? If I accept Rav Henkin's standard, If I accept Rav Henkin's standard, then common law marriage may well be accepted in Judaism because it's clear they intended an ongoing monogamous relationship. However, if I take everybody else who say you have to want it to be halachic marriage, then common law marriage doesn't indicate that at all. I'm really going to go forward because there's just too much here. I apologize, Ivan. But there's way too much to discuss still. So the truth of the matter is that after the conclusion of the Gemara, halachic authorities argue that an individual's actions can demonstrate that he, she, does not fit our assumptions about human psychology. That the Gemara's assumption about what's going on, the Gemara's mind reading, falls apart. Argument number one is what Shana said before, and she's been very patient with it. The Rivash mentions it in source number 15. I did not translate that one. But in the second paragraph of it, there's no message in which ones I translated and which ones I didn't, except that I ran out of time. And I figured as I got further in, it was less likely that we're going to get to the actual source anyway. But if you take a look at number 15, at the second paragraph, he says, it's the second line in the second paragraph, after the period, the case he's giving involved anusin. They were Jews who have been forced to accept outwardly the appearance of Christianity. And they got married in a church with a priest. So he says, if you're going to get married in a church with a priest, it's pretty clear that you don't intend it as kiddushin. Now, I might have argued that's not true. They didn't have other options. What else were they going to do? They're trying to put on a face before the world of living as Christians. But that's the argument that he makes. The Rivash says it. He's quoted in the Beis Yosef. Moshe Feinstein says this. And Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach says this as well. That the very fact that somebody chooses a civil ceremony instead of a religious ceremony makes a statement about what they're thinking. They're not intending it to be a halachic marriage. That's number one. Number two, also brought by the Rivash, as well as by the Radbaz, is This person engages in sinful behavior in general. He notes, and it's in the third paragraph of source number 15, there's a requirement in Jewish law that after a man proposes to a woman, she is treated as a nida. She's treated as menstruate in the sense that there will be a requirement for a period of time and a trip to the mikvah before they get married. A Jewish woman goes to mikvah before marriage. A Jewish man also, it's a different custom, but this is a matter of law that she should be going to mikvah. When they engage in their civil marriage, says the Rivash, she doesn't go to mikvah. So he makes the following very interesting argument. He says, if they're willing to violate the laws of Nida, then why would you assume that they care about the laws of zinut, the laws of living together without the benefit of marriage? Meaning, in halacha, which one is more severe? Which sin is worse? Violating the laws of zinut, where he's single and she is single? Or violating the laws of nida? Nida. Nida is more severe. So therefore, the argument can be made, if he's willing to violate a serious sin like Nida, so then, of course, he's willing to violate this issue of Zinut. Rabbi Kiva Eger takes this and applies it further as well. So therefore, the requirement that she go to mikvah before the marriage. Yeah, then they're violating a law. So if they're willing to violate that law, why do you think that they care about having a halachic marriage, which is not as important as the law of her going to mikvah beforehand? That's the argument.
So it's a sin not to go to mikvah?
Ostensibly, yes. Well, not going to mikvah, but being together after that, yeah. So that's the argument. So even if you're willing to tell me that we make this assumption about their relationship and about their intentions, as far as the Gemara is concerned, it really doesn't seem to hold water. Now, the truth of the matter is that there are challenges one can bring to this act of mind reading. The idea of mind reading based on actions, of saying, well, I'm looking at his actions and they're inconsistent with what we think is the conduct of somebody who cares about Zinut. There are objections to this. In the interest of time, I'm going to, I think, skip the first two of them and only bring the third. The third is from a Gemara in Temura in source number 17. There are a few different back and forths, but I'm going to save time on this point because it's not relevant to the direct issue. The Gemara in Temura deals with the following. I gave you prefaces in the translation because I thought that might help rather than harm. If I have a karban, an animal that I've dedicated as a sacrifice for the Beis HaMikdash, for the temple, and then it gets a blemish, what do? It gets a defect. I redeem it. I redeem it for cash, and then I use that to buy a new animal as a carbon, or I redeem it directly for another animal. Redemption is fine. However, there's another type of dedication of another animal in which I would, instead of redeeming it, I would substitute it. I would say, this animal is holy in place of that one. Not only does that not work, substitution doesn't work, redemption works. I am exchanging it for cash and then using the cash to get something new. That works. Substitution not only does not work, but it works worse. In the sense that now both animals are holy and I have broken the law. That's called temura. I've broken the law and there are penalties for it. So the Gemara asks a fascinating question in number 17. Let's say the following. Man has four karbanot in front of him, four animals that he's dedicated as a sacrifice. And then he has four other animals that are mundane. One of the sacred animals has a mum, has a defect, such that I could redeem it. Okay? I said, these four are exchanged for those four. With my first three, I definitely violated a prohibition, because that's temura, that's the substitution. For the fourth one, there's a permitted way it could work. If I have it in mind as redemption, not as substitution, since it has a blemish, redemption works. So the question is, can I read his mind, asks the Gemara, and say, even though he sinned the first three times, the fourth one he did in a proper way. Can I make that assumption? That's the Gemara's question in source number 17. The Gemara says, We're not sure. We don't know if you can assume that he would have done it right. So Asher Weiss brings this and says, from the fact that we're willing to consider that even if you messed up three times, on your fourth opportunity you did it right, maybe you could make that argument here. He then argues against, but I bring it just to show you this kind of discussion of how to read people's actions. There's a lot to be said about this act of mind reading. My friend Rabbi Daniel Tzvi Feldman, in one of his shiurim on this, pointed out that this whole exercise is actually a little bit strange. We're making the argument here, and I wouldn't say this on tape, except that he said it on tape, and therefore I feel safe saying it, because he did it too. But we're making the argument here that you can extrapolate based on the severity of someone's sins. If a person violated a sin with this level of severity, then for sure he'd violate a sin with this level of severity, with a lower level of severity. If they're willing to overlook neither, then they're probably willing to engage in zinut. So he asked the following question in his shiur. Someone comes to you and says, I have a choice. I can either marry a Jewish woman and we won't observe mikvah at all, or I can marry a non-Jewish woman. I can intermarry. But those are my options. We've taken romance out of this. Those are my options. I have two women I could marry. Either Jewish woman, we won't observe mikvah, or non-Jewish woman. What advice would you give him?
Not the above.
I'm assuming you can't say none of the above, right? You'd still say marry a Jewish woman. Which one, halakhically, is better? Right. Marrying the non-Jewish woman avoids violating all the different prohibitions that he would be violating in the event that he married a woman and they didn't observe mikvah. But God forbid that we should ever give anybody that kind of advice.
But isn't it about marrying somebody?
Yeah, but it's not as serious as mikvah. Mikvah is correct. We're not going to ever give anybody that advice. Please don't do that. Please, I'm talking to the recorder. Don't do that. We're not actually going to advise that because there are meta issues that are involved. There are bigger issues that are involved. And that's true in other areas of halacha as well. This one is just a particularly dramatic one where it comes up. It comes up in other areas of halacha too. But the point that I'm bringing this for is to say, it's not so clear that you can deduce if he does this, that means he'll do that. Because he did something that's more severe, therefore he'll also do something less severe. People's perceptions are funny. The human mind works in funny ways. And people don't necessarily make their calculation, and halacha does not necessarily make its calculation, based on a simple math of this is more severe, this is less severe. It's not always the way halacha works. It's certainly not the way that the human mind works. But the point that should emerge from what we've said so far in this is, when we read this person's mind, and we say, well, their intention would not be for znut, the argument in response is, look at their conduct. The fact that they opted for civil marriage, the fact that they don't care about nida, may indicate that your assumptions about people's approach to halacha are wrong. They don't apply in this particular circumstance. That's number one. Number two, Rav Asher Weiss makes another argument, which I brought you in source number 18. He says, maybe the assumption that people don't intend a promiscuous relationship isn't about this person and his approach to Torah. It's about society as a whole. That people as a whole don't believe in promiscuity. In which case, he says in number 18, that ship has sailed. Because that's certainly not the world that we live in. We live in a world in which things are much more free and loose. And people don't necessarily assign great value to a long-term monogamous relationship. So therefore, the idea that you're going to read the mind of this party and say, I think he intends marriage, has a lot of holes and a lot of reason to suspect it. So, big picture again. Our question is, when the couple gets married civilly, can their relations count as an act of kiddushin? Because they're thinking about getting married, assuming that we take the view of Rav Henkin, they just have to intend a monogamous relationship. If we take the view of everybody else, almost everybody else, they have to be intending a religious relationship. It seems very hard to sustain the view that that's what they have in mind. But here's an interesting side question that comes up. Now you're telling me that this chazaka, this presumed status that the Gemara articulated, that this person is going to have in mind a monogamous relationship and not a promiscuous relationship, you're telling me that that doesn't apply. Are you trying to tell me that the sages were wrong when they presented their assumption? Was that simply incorrect? Has the world moved on? That's a very loaded and important sentence if you're going to say that, because so much of halacha relies on assumptions about human psychology, the way people operate. If they don't know the way we operate, that's going to change our approach to many laws, not just this one. Yes?
My problem with that statement is the prevalence. In the time of Chazal, it could have been this small number.
Mm-hmm.
In the Yomeinu, it may be this big number.
Yeah.
But it's the number that's different, not the psychology.
Except that once the number changes in a very significant way, that says that people's thinking is no longer the way it was. It's no longer... Yeah.
Not
yes.
Necessarily. They ignore halacha in favor of the following, and they're doing it more openly since the so-called...
But this isn't about halacha. If I'm taking the view, the majority view, that they don't have to intend Jewish marriage, they just have to intend a monogamous relationship in which they're committed to each other. And the sages are telling me in the Gemara, well, of course people want an ongoing monogamous relationship. That's for sure what they want. And now we're saying, no, they don't actually want an ongoing monogamous relationship necessarily. That reflects a different approach psychologically than the one that the sages assumed in the Gemara. Take a look at number 19. Number 19, Rav Yosef Dos Soloveitchik made a statement which has become famous, in which he argued that the chazaka is the presumption that certain facts remain true. The assumption we have walking in, he says it can't change. Let me add something that is very important, he says. Not only the halachos, the laws, but also the chazakos, which Chachmei Chazal, our sages, have introduced, are indestructible. We must not tamper not only with the halachos, but even with the chazakos. For the chazakos of which Chazal spoke rest not upon transient psychological behavioral patterns, but upon permanent ontological principles rooted in the very depth of the human personality, in the metaphysical human personality, which is as changeless as the heavens above. Now, he wasn't talking about our case. He was dealing with a separate issue, which requires its own set of shiurim, and that was tav lemeitav teindu, the idea that women have a natural preference for being in a committed relationship, which is fascinating in its own right, but not for right now. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, though, says, these assumptions that we make about psychology in the Gemara are like law. They don't change. So how can you tell me here, everybody is willing to say that this principle of people don't engage in znut, right, is still true, you know, is not true anymore? I don't understand. So Moshe Be'eri, in the interest of time, I'm going to have to go ahead with this.
Very important.
That, I'm sure.
By saying, if a woman doesn't go to the mikvah, does the man choose a woman who's not Jewish or a woman who doesn't go to the mikvah? I mean, you're talking about two separate things.
Right, so I can come back to that, but because of the time, I need to come back to it after. Moshe Be'eri makes the argument in number 20 that there are different types of chazaka. Rabbi Soloveitchik isn't talking about all chazakot. There is a chazaka which is based on acquired behavior, and then there is a chazaka that's based on human nature. And his argument is that the chazaka that people don't engage in promiscuous relations when they have the option to engage in a proper marital one, that assumption, he says, is based on human behavior. It's not based on a basic human nature. And therefore it can change. Human behavior becomes different. People don't acquire this chazaka. But the truth of the matter is that I think you don't need to go there. Because the Gemara itself didn't really mean that this chazaka should apply in all cases. And my evidence for this is the Rambam in source number 21. When the Rambam makes the statement, and in the interest of time, I'm going to sum it up, but you can see the text there. The Rambam says, you cannot possibly tell me that every time a single man and a single woman sleep together, it's for the sake of marriage. It's just not true. It's flat out not true. The Rambam said it. He lived in a time and place which I think people would generally consider much more restrictive morally and ethically and in terms of social norms than today. He's living in 12th century Egypt. A very different world from ours. And he still says it. It can't be. That's not what the Gemara was ever trying to say. That's the position taken by the Rambam and others as well. The Trumas Hadeshin in source number 22 and the Shulchan Aruch in source number 23. The case is in the Gemara. A case in which a man said that he wants to marry her and he just set a condition first for the Kiddush and then omitted it at the time of marriage. Or a case in which they've been married already. They got divorced and then they slept together. There I'm willing to say, you know what my assumption is? That's that they had marriage in mind. But not that every single time a man and a woman are together, we're going to assume that it's with marriage in mind. I don't think this is really an issue of human psychology changing. I think the Gemara always knew. When they made this statement, they weren't applying it to all cases. And the cases that we're talking about today, they would never have dreamed of applying that principle. So at this stage, the heavy weight of the argument is to say that this is not halachic marriage. The intent during Bia is not intent for marriage. The last piece of this, and that is, what about social engineering? So the Maarche Lev, Rabbi Yehuda Lev Zirilson, I brought him a number 24, makes the following argument. He says, this man and this woman got a civil marriage. They lived together for 3, 5, 7, 10 years. Everybody knew them as Mr. and Mrs. Doctor and Mrs. Doctor and Doctor, Mr. and Doctor, whatever they are. So and so. They got invited to events. They sat together at programs. They went to shul, wherever they went. It was on the basis of the world thinking, this is a married couple. One day, the world finds out, things haven't been so pretty, things haven't been so happy, it's not working out. They decide that they're going to separate. No get. Because you just told me civil marriage isn't halachic marriage. So they can simply get divorced and that's it. They don't need a get. What's that going to do to people's assumptions about divorce? Rabbi Zirilson makes the argument that people are going to believe a get is not required. So we should have a get simply to make sure that people will understand that get in general is needed. Rabbi Shlomo Dykovsky made a similar argument. I brought it for you in number 25. He made a similar argument in Israel saying that in a case where a Beit Din, a religious court, said no get was needed, you need a decision of the Beit Din, of the religious court, to separate them. Just like if you had a marriage of people who were not Jewish. They want to use the requirement of a get in order to make sure that people will understand that get really is required for halachic marriage in order to safeguard that rule. However, there's a lot of opposition to this. Number one, it creates the problems we noted in our introduction. It could create an aguna situation. What if a guy doesn't want to give the get? The inability to marry a kohen. What happens if they didn't have a get? She got married again, and now you're going to call the kid a mamzer because for social engineering purposes, you wanted to make sure that they would have a get? That's number one. Number two, Rav Asher Weiss notes in number 26, we don't create takanos. We don't create new rules. You can't just say that. After civil marriage, you require a get now. That's not right. And number three, that Sitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg goes the opposite direction. He says, no, you're making things worse by requiring a get. You think you're social engineering in order to save marriage, just the opposite. You're going to ruin halachic marriage. Because once you tell the world that if they get married at City Hall, and then they want to end the marriage, they need a get, what you're telling them is, there's no difference between civil marriage and halachic marriage. That's the Tzitzel Yezer's point in number 27. He says, just the opposite. Mitoch shemachri mitchiloso mekel besofo. You think you're creating a chumra, just the opposite. You're making things worse. You don't want to do that. So he says, you have to be very careful with this game of, I think I want to add, because you end up subtracting when you do that. So the upshot of all of this, I have one more piece, but it's 11:30, and so I want to make sure to do a summary, and then those who can stay for a last piece, because they hate those who can't, I understand and I'm not offended. But the upshot of all of this is, civil marriage does not look like halachic marriage. They're different. They're not the same. The only argument that really is taken seriously is that when they sleep together, if the intent is for marriage, then they have kiddushin. However, in order for that to be real, you would require that they had intent for halachic marriage. They intended Jewish marriage, according to most authorities, not Rav Henkin, but most other authorities think so. That's number one. And number two, that requires making assumptions about what he has in mind that seem to be defied by his actions. He doesn't seem to care about marriage and all about halacha and Jewish marriage, you know, but the fact that they went for a civil ceremony in the first place, the fact that they're not concerned about other halachic issues, like by what right do you make the assumption that that's what they have in mind here? So the general tendency is that when a case like this comes up in front of a Beit Din, they say, yes, we want a get. We want to have a get. We would like to satisfy the view of Rav Henkin. We would like to make sure that people are careful about marriage in general. We would like to make sure people understand that a get is required to end a marriage. However, if the result of that would be an aguna situation, if the result of that would be a mamzer situation, then generally speaking, they hold off and they say, no, we're not gonna require a get. We don't want to make things worse. You have loads and loads of authorities who thought this was not an issue, many more than I quoted here. So again, if anyone has to leave, you can go. I have another 5 to 10 minutes on one last piece that is fascinating. There's one other way to recognize civil marriage as being halachically effective, and that is to argue it's a partial halachic marriage. Those who come to the Kiddushin Shiurim that we have on Fridays here in the Beis Medrash, on Fridays at 10:30, are already familiar with this idea from a shiur I gave in the beginning of the year. Rabbi Yisrael Gustman, the Kuntrasei Shiurim, floated the idea that marriage in Judaism is actually comprised of three divisible parts. The three parts are kinyan, transaction, prohibition to the rest of the world, as is a monogamous relationship, prohibited to the rest of the world, and ishut, marriage to each other, like what we call kiddushin. Three different components. Kinyan, the transaction, prohibited to the rest of the world is a second piece of it, and that you have a marriage relationship with this person is actually a third part of it. And what he suggested is, each of the steps of kiddushin corresponds to one of those. Kesef, Shtar, Bia. Each one of those corresponds to one of these. Kesef is Kenyan, is transaction. Shtar, the document, is the prohibition to the rest of the world. And Bia, relations, is they're in a marriage relationship with each other. Not that you need all three to create Kiddushin. Once you have one, it automatically extends to the other two. But that's the way he looked at it. And he made the argument, and I brought you a Rambam on the sheet that supports this, and Rav Chaim Halevi that supports this in 28 and 29. But he made the argument that it is possible to have a case where the kinyan works, the transaction works, however the other parts of the marriage do not take effect. Just the transaction works, but the other parts, the prohibition to the rest of the world and the marriage to each other, actually do not take effect. If you can read the Hebrew and want to see Rav Chaim on it in number 29, you can. But I'm going to bring you easier examples than the one that he brings. Rav Elchanan Wasserman makes the same statement on the Gemara in Kiddushin Dav Zayin. I'll give you an example. Pilegesh. What's a pilegesh? A concubine. Concubine. According to most authorities, there's no such thing in Judaism, that only a king could do it post-biblically. Only kings have the option of doing that. There is a minority view, most famous because of Rav Yaakov Emden's support for it, that suggests that, in fact, Pilegesh could happen, but that's not my concern. A Pilegesh relationship basically means they agree to be together for now, and when they decide they're no longer together, then they're no longer together. They can just dissolve it. That's a concubine relationship. It has no ketubah. It has no chuppah. It doesn't have the standard protections involved or obligations involved in a marriage relationship. It's an incomplete form of marriage. And let's say, God forbid, there's a concubine relationship between a man and a woman, and then she lives with somebody else. Is that called eshet ish? Is that called adultery? The answer is no. Nope. Similarly, for those who are familiar with the case of a Shifcha Harufa, I'm not going to get into it right now, it's a very complicated case, but in the case of Shifcha Harufa as well, she gets involved with somebody else, that is not called adultery, it doesn't carry the same rules of adultery. And the same will apply to marriage among non-Jews. Marriage among non-Jews. Okay, so John A. McDonald gets married to, I don't know, Victoria. They get married to each other in a non-Jewish ceremony because they're not Jewish. Halacha recognizes that marriage. Halacha absolutely recognizes that marriage. We have the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, the laws that apply to all human beings, apply to them as well. However, in the event that there is some form of infidelity, the rules of Esh and Ish, of adultery, do not pertain. The marriage applies in part, not all three components, but some component. So Rav Yosef Rosen, the Ragachover, made the argument that the same thing is going to be true here. Just like those precedents, he said the same thing is going to be true for civil marriage. That civil marriage creates kinyan, just like it would for two non-Jews who wanted to get married. It creates kinyan, there is a transaction between them, there is a level of bond between them, but there is no other bond. It doesn't create a bond such that there would be Esh and Ish adultery issues that are involved. It's a fascinating idea. It leads to the remarkable assumption then that there's some other kind of get that's required for a case like this. Not the get that we are familiar with, but some other kind of get. The problem with that idea is that the Rambam believes that when non-Jews get married to each other and they want to end the marriage, no get is required. The Rashba, on the other hand, believes that if non-Jews get married to each other, there's no such option of divorce. It's like the Catholic Church, that divorce isn't an option. No one actually has. You will not find a text of a get for Bnei Noach, because either you don't need it or you can't have it. So I don't know what the Ragachover is exactly conceptualizing here, and I conclude on that point with Rav Asher Weiss's comment in number 31. Look at the last line. Ach ein advarm halalu ala chidush besignuno hamiyuchad shal gaon zed derech nesher bashamayim. He says this is just a Ragachover style chidush. It's brilliant. It makes sense on a level, but the implementation is not going to be practical. This isn't he says, ach, ein ze ikar la halacha klal. But it's a fascinating way to look at it, and it's very different from everybody else's way of looking at civil marriage. Everyone else is looking at it as either it's nothing, or they have in mind that it's like halacha. And he says, no, it's actually both. It has one component, doesn't have the other components. Fascinating way to look at it. Again, today, in our day, we try to arrange a get for civil marriage where it's doable because of the halachic authorities who require it. But generally speaking, we are comfortable looking at the person's actions and saying these demonstrate that they weren't concerned about halachic marriage in the first place, and therefore the civil marriage is not the equal of halachic marriage. And now I'll take the questions that I had held. And again, for anyone who has to go, absolutely understood. But thank you very much. Johan first, and then Marlene. Yeah.